We all belong outside. We are drawn to nature. It calls to us. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to, or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives richer, calmer, and frankly, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby or trails worth traveling to and explore confidently with offline maps and on-trail navigation. Whether you're looking for a laid-back walk with family or something more adventurous to get your heart pumping, AllTrails gives you the tools you need to get out there and find your outside. Download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails.
Culpable is released every Monday and brought to you absolutely free. But for early binge access, ad-free listening, and exclusive content, subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus at tenderfootplus.com or on Apple Podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals interviewed and participating in the show and do not represent those of Tenderfoot TV. All individuals described or mentioned in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law. This podcast contains subject matter such as violence, drug use, and other graphic descriptions, which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
When's the last time that you saw Danny Violet?
Friday night.
Did he stay at your house?
Yeah.
What time did you leave your house?
I was sleeping when he left.
How was he when he got there?
Bad.
Okay, explain bad.
He was just like making no sense, like, because he's got that mental problem.
Mm-hmm. Think he was on anything?
Yeah.
What was he on?
Acid.
How do you know he was on acid?
He told me.
Did you ever talk about old what do you say about him?
Said he was pretty cool, I guess.
How much do you owe him, do you know? But you don't know anybody who'd have a beef against him?
Yeah, I don't know. I never met the kid.
That's why we need his friends right now, okay? And if it was a young person that did this, he's gonna be able to find out. But another young person, right?
Well, they would know better to say something about it around us.
How do you
want to
do it? You
want to
sit in the front with Eric? You want me to sit back here?
Wherever you guys are comfortable, I'm driving.
That actually might not be a bad idea because then you're closer to her with the mic.
On a mild summer afternoon, my producer John and I climb into Danielle and Eric's minivan to take a drive around the city of Willard. Eric used to live in the area back in the 90s when all this happened, so he asked if he could tell us a little more about the town itself and show us some of the places that relate to Danny's case.
How would you describe, like, Willard area from, like, late 90s?
So, like, I grew up out in the country, and we kind of just ran and did our own thing. We didn't have a lot of supervision. It was kind of that generation of, like, you know, be inside when the streetlights come on. I didn't know Willard as being crime-ridden or drug-ridden, anything like that. There were kind of the good parts of town and the bad parts of town, but I was too young at that time to really care about the details. A lot of my friends, we were all just smoking pot. We smoked cigarettes, we drank underage. Honestly, we were good kids.
Yeah.
It's just what people did,
yeah.
You know.
Eric tells us Willard is a fairly simple and quiet town, built on farmers and factory workers. For teenagers, there wasn't a lot to do in the 3.5 square miles that make up the town. So it's really no surprise that folks like him and Danny spent much of their time out and about with friends, getting into whatever it is that teens get into. That's how he became so familiar with the lay of the land.
There's two roads. This is Kiefer, and then the next one that goes parallel with this is Main Street.
Okay.
This is, we're on Town Line 12, so the field is off of Town Line 12.
Yeah, it's down that way,
but Kiefer, this leads you into the east side. Okay. The east side of Willard.
Would you say that Willard looks pretty similar now than it did back then?
Willard hasn't changed much. I mean, right now, it looks like, in my opinion, like people are taking pride in their yards, taking pride in, you know, their houses, and as they should, but...
See the justice signs?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
There's a couple on the other side, too.
How many of those are floating around here?
Over 100.
Oh, wow. There's one over there, too.
See this up here, this clock tower? That's where we'll have...
Though Willard looks about the same now as it did back in the 90s, there is at least one stark difference, courtesy of Danielle and Eric. Since they started advocating for Danny, there's been a resurgence of interest in his case amongst the locals here, which is made evident by the freshly printed black and orange signs planted in several front lawns that read, "Justice for Danny." They tell me they've lost count of how many they've printed now, but I can tell you there's enough spread around that it practically makes a trail leading to Danny's house.
So here's Tiffin.
This is their house, right?
Not this one. It's this one.
Oh, this one with the porch.
Yeah, right here. His brother saw him go out the back door and down the alley. So that means he would have been walking this.
As a refresher, Danny ran away from his home at approximately 1 p.m. on Saturday, October 24th, 1998, after returning home from a night out with some friends. His brother Ross watched as Danny walked down the alleyway that runs up to their house until he was out of sight. Where he went after remains somewhat of a question mark.
Saturday is more of a mystery. Now he's seen at the YMCA.
So Danny was down this road for sure, up to the intersection, which is where the YMCA is, the grocery store. This would have been Missler's.
So the last sighting of him was allegedly here, right? You know, was it like they had been at the store?
According to police narratives, the last known sighting of Danny happened just hours after leaving his home. A person reported seeing him around 7 p.m. near Missler's, a grocery store in the heart of town. To my knowledge, he was never seen again until the afternoon of November 4th, when his body was found in a cornfield on the outskirts of town.
So you see the Willard City Limit sign, right?
Yeah.
This is where it ends. And then here's the field.
After the discovery of the body, authorities, led by Detective Bob McLaughlin with the Huron County Sheriff's Office, started bringing Danny's friends into the station one by one for questioning. As they attempted to nail down a timeline leading up to Danny's death, their first real lead would instead have them moving backwards to the day before he went missing. In our last episode, we heard from Steve, a friend of Danny's, who shared a rather alarming story about the night of Friday the 23rd. He told McLaughlin that he and four other friends, Danny, Judd, Adam, and Matt, spent that night together. And there are actually two parts to his story that we need to focus on here. First, Steve described a health scare that Danny had that night, from the sounds of it, a seizure, after taking some acid that he picked up in the neighboring town of Galleon earlier that night. This is concerning for obvious reasons, which we'll get into later. However, we know that eventually those symptoms subsided. And come Saturday morning, Danny, while lethargic and a bit incoherent, was technically alive and well, meaning the seizure he had that night did not kill him. But it was the other part of Steve's story that seemed to pique McLaughlin's interest, that trip that three of the friends made to pick up the acid. According to Steve, Danny didn't purchase those drugs. Rather, they were fronted to him, and he was supposed to repay the supplier the next day. After Danny went missing, Steve said he heard a rumor through their friend Adam that the supplier of the drugs had been making threats against Danny over the debt he owed.
Dan Castle was told by
Yes. Oh my God.
Is that he better put the money back to him or he's gonna beat his ass?
Yes.
And with this, detectives had a solid lead to chase, as well as a possible motive. Now, they need to speak with the rest of Danny's friends to hear their side of the story before tracking down this person of interest.
All right, Judd. You have middle initial or middle name?
Well, my first name's Judson.
The next friend we're going to hear from is Judd. He was interviewed by Detective Terry Robinson with the Willard Police, who quickly got into the events of Friday night.
When's the last time that you saw Danny Violet?
Friday night, I think it was. Friday or Saturday night.
Did he stay at your house?
Yeah.
What time did you leave your house?
I was sleeping when he left.
Was it on Saturday or Friday?
Yeah,
daylight?
Saturday morning.
What time did you get to your house?
Around midnight, Friday night.
How was he when he got there?
Bad.
Okay, explain bad.
He was just like making no sense, like, because he's got that mental problem.
Mm-hmm. Think he was on anything?
Yeah.
What was he on?
Acid.
How do you know he was on acid?
He told me.
Do you have any more with him?
He did then, but I don't know if he does.
Did you ever talk about old
Yeah.
What do you say about him?
Said he was pretty cool, I guess. Him and Adam were them three were in the same class together.
What three?
Adam and Danny.
Okay.
Said he was a pretty cool guy.
When Detective Robinson starts to press Judd about the trip to Galleon and the supplier who Danny owed money to, Judd explains that he really doesn't know much about it. Like Steve, he didn't meet up with the rest of the group until late Friday night, after the other friends had picked up the acid, and he never even met the person who supplied it. Authorities would need to turn their attention to Adam and Matt, the two friends who accompanied Danny on that trip to Galleon. Let's listen to Adam's account. He was interviewed by Detective McLaughlin in a separate room. Just a warning, he's very soft-spoken, and the audio is a little hard to understand in parts. So listen closely.
When was the last time you saw Danny Violet?
Saturday, October 24th.
What board did you see him at?
Joe Dickerson's house.
Was he acting kind of weird?
Yes.
What we understand is that he got himself some acid, some paper acid from and he wanted it back, otherwise he was gonna kick his ass. That's my understanding.
He said what?
My understanding was that he wanted his money back, or was gonna kick Danny's butt, but he didn't get his money back. Is that true?
I haven't heard that. No.
Okay. Well, I just spoke to Steven, and that's what he said that you said.
Oh. He just said that he wanted somebody better find Danny so I beat him up or something like that.
Yeah.
Did
you talk to him face to face?
Yeah, I talked to him every day.
Okay. Prior to him?
Yeah.
Is he the type of person that will go ahead and take it that far?
No. I don't think so.
Now, I understand friendships, and I understand, the thing about being a rat and not being a rat and all that. This kid's dead. So if we can find out who did it, that's where we want to go. If it's about dope, then that's just, that's the way it is. But if we can find these guys and get them in jail where they belong, that's where we're headed. If he was upset enough to go ahead and do something like that or get a hold of some people to help him find Danny and do that, then that's what we're trying to solve this puzzle.
Adam would end up telling McLaughlin a rather vague and convoluted account of the boys' trip to pick up the acid. He said they drove to a few different houses in a few different towns that night, and claimed he didn't know anything about the acid until some time later, when they arrived back in Willard. Now, there was just one more friend that authorities would need to verify the story with. Detective Robinson would handle this one. Again, some of the audio is a little hard to understand, so listen closely.
And your name is Matt?
Mm-hmm.
Middle initial?
C.
Slong?
Yeah.
You don't think any violent?
Yeah, it's like my good friend.
Good friends?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you known him?
It wasn't a year.
You have known him a year?
No. I just started hanging around him like this summer.
Okay. When's the last time that you saw Dan?
The video ends just as Robinson is asking Matt when he last saw Danny. But as the next video starts, he confirms it was Saturday morning, around 11 a.m. at Judd's house, just as the other friends had reported. Robinson shifts the focus to the night before.
Did you see him Friday night?
Yep.
What time Friday night?
Probably soon. Why?
Did you go anyplace with him?
Haven't.
You went someplace with, where'd you go?
Galley.
Okay, you went to Galley. What did you do in Galley?
He seen a friend.
Who?
I don't know. I don't go to school right now because my back's bad. Mm-hmm. I got to get a rod in my back. He goes Pioneer.
Right. So you rode over there, but you don't know the kid's name? What'd he get? He didn't tell you?
I'm like Dean's like father, like figure. I try to like keep him out of stuff. Whenever he try to do something, then I try to like help him in this like.
Did you see him get anything from this kid?
Not that I know of.
Did he take anything in the car on the way back? Was he drinking?
He don't drink.
He don't drink. Does he do drugs?
He talks about it all the time.
Talks about what?
Acid.
Talks about acid all the time?
Yep.
Is that what you guys went over to get that name?
I don't know, but he talks about it all the time.
Does he talk about anything else?
Similar to Adam, Matt gave a vague account of Friday night, both the trip to pick up the acid and what happened after returning to Willard. He admitted that they drove to Galleon that night, but claimed he didn't know the reason for their trip, nor did he know the person who supplied the acid. After speaking with the friends, authorities didn't have a ton of details to work with, but still, they had more than enough reason to go and question this individual who Danny supposedly owed money to. They'd first make contact with him later that day, on November 4th. Unfortunately, the recording of that interview is very difficult to understand, but according to the narratives, it doesn't appear that much was learned in that meeting. However, the following day, he'd informed detectives he had more information to share regarding the events of Friday night. So detectives set out for Galleon once again. But in a wild turn of events, before they could even make it there, a discovery would be made back at the cornfield that would help solidify their working theory. On November 5th, 1998, the day after Danny's body was discovered, authorities were dispatched to the scene once again, after John Wiles, the farmer who found Danny's body, reported some additional items of interest he found in the field. Captain Annette McLaughlin, Bob's wife, who also worked for the Huron County Sheriff's Office, would be the responding officer. Here's what she reported.
At approximately 11:30 a.m., while at the Willard Police Department, I was dispatched to the crime scene on Town Line Road 12 to meet with John and Jim Wiles. Upon arrival, the Wiles showed me to an area west of where the deceased was found in the cornfield. Laying in the corn row was a black wallet along with cash and some other light-colored paper. This area was not disturbed. A phone call to BCI was made regarding the recovery. Agent Joe Dietz was to respond to the location. Statements were taken from John and Jim Wiles. Captain DeWitt later arrived on scene. While looking over the area, he noticed what appeared to be some type of clothing. Agent Dietz was on the scene at that time, and it was found that the clothing was a gray shirt. The shirt was under the combine and just east of where the wallet was located. Agent Dietz processed the scene.
It's a bit concerning that authorities failed to find this evidence when they processed the scene on day one. If you remember, the only thing they reported besides the body itself was a 31 by 14 foot patch of corn that had been knocked down, roughly 7 yards away. Of course, there's a possibility that the items were dumped there sometime after they cleared the scene, so that's important to keep in mind. But I think the likelier scenario is they just didn't do a thorough enough search or a wide enough canvas of the area, and the items were simply overlooked. Regardless, this was a pretty big discovery. The evidence retrieved that day included Danny's wallet, some ripped up cash, $6 to be exact, and his gray Michigan University t-shirt, the same one he was said to be wearing in the missing persons report. Now, there are conflicting numbers when it comes to the exact location of the items and their proximity to where the body was found, but from the sounds of it, the wallet and money were found together, roughly 40 yards away, and the shirt was a little closer, roughly 30 yards away. For me, this raises a lot of questions. Why would there be a large patch of corn knocked down outside the line of harvesting? Could a fight have broken out there? What else could have caused that? Same thing with Danny's shirt. Could it have been removed during a fight? Why was it so far away from the body? And then the wallet. Did it just fall out of his pocket? Or does it somehow tie in with the ripped up money that was found with? Could he have been trying to repay someone and didn't have enough? There's just so many possibilities when you consider all the evidence found at the scene, but it does start to paint a picture nonetheless. With this discovery, authorities now had physical evidence to support their working theory that Danny may have been killed over a debt. Now, they need to speak with the person he owed. Here's Detective McLaughlin.
Hey, date is November 5th, 1998. Time is approximately 12:20. We're at the residence of his mother and father present, along with Detective Scott, Guy MPD, and Prosecutor's Investigator Bob McDowell, Sheridan County Prosecutor's Office. Okay.
Yesterday, you asked me if I knew anything about the acid that you got. Well, I want to clarify that the acid and anything that happened to Danny had no relevancy to each other.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
Like, one had nothing to do with the other. And I'm positive because I know that I didn't do anything, and Danny come down here and asked me to get that for him, and I did.
Okay. You're sure that the fact that he purchased acid?
He didn't purchase acid.
Or the acid was part of to him had nothing to do with why he's dead today? Yeah.
I'm 100% for sure.
Okay, how can you say that? I mean, how do you know?
Because I'm the only one that knew, besides Adam and the other kid that was with us.
It's hard to make out what's being said here, but essentially the supplier tells McLaughlin that he had nothing to do with Danny's death, nor did the acid deal that happened on Friday night. McLaughlin then asks the supplier to break down what happened that night, and like Danny's friends, he too gives a rather convoluted account. The only difference is, his account is much more thorough and detailed. Due to the poor audio quality and redactions of names and places, I'm going to do my best to summarize and make it a little more digestible. Here's the story. Friday night, Adam drove Matt and Danny to Galleon, where they picked up the supplier from his house. From there, the group drove to a nearby house where they picked up one of the supplier's friends, before driving to another house in the town of Nevada, roughly 30 minutes away, where it sounds like a party was happening. There, they dropped off the friend who they picked up at the previous stop. Then, the supplier rode with Adam, Matt, and Danny back to his home in Galleon, where he ended up borrowing money from his mom that, unbeknownst to her, would be used to purchase the acid. The group then drove back to the house in Nevada, where they dropped off the friend earlier. This time, Danny and Matt stayed behind, while Adam drove the supplier and two men who were at the party to a house in the town of Bucyrus, roughly 15 minutes away. There, the supplier purchased one sheet of acid, or 25 hits, for a total of $85, which he admits Danny was supposed to repay the following day. The group then left Bucyrus and returned to the house in Nevada where Danny and Matt had stayed. But upon arrival, sheriff's officers showed up at the house looking for a kid who had been missing. Eventually, the officers left. At that point, the supplier found Danny and handed him the sheet of acid. Then Adam, Matt, and Danny headed back to Matt's house in Willard. Overall, the story seems pretty convincing. It was detailed and included names and locations, as well as an encounter with the sheriff's office that he'd likely only know about if he was there, one that was later confirmed by detectives. On top of that, he was honest about buying the acid and even how he got the money to pay for it, with his mom sitting right there beside him. And he never shied away from the fact that Danny was supposed to repay him that money. He offered to take a polygraph test multiple times over to prove his innocence. At one point in the conversation, his father even presses McLaughlin and asks why his son is being treated as a suspect. McLaughlin admits that he didn't think he was directly involved. Rather, he was concerned that it could have involved someone else, like the two men who went with them to Bucyrus to pick up the acid.
You don't know who these other guys were? Why were they along? Any idea?
But you went and got it.
And then they gave it to you and you gave it to
them? Yeah, they said it would be better if I didn't know their names.
Did they have any idea where Danny lived?
No.
Did they ever been, have they ever been
they before? Have no, they didn't even meet Danny.
Okay.
That's why I'm sure that they had no relevancy to it.
So how did Danny wind up dead?
I have no idea. None whatsoever.
You or the other two guys didn't get upset about him not getting the money and going
No, I paid for it.
Okay, you got it from these other two guys. You paid them $85, then you gave it to
Danny.
$25 to Danny.
Yeah.
Okay. So the other two guys we don't know.
The other two guys didn't even know Danny.
The other two guys that we don't know
had no contact.
Got their money. Yeah. They were happy. The sale was complete.
Yeah.
The only person that was on the hook was you.
Yeah.
Or Danny. I'm sorry. Danny was on the hook for you for the $85.
Just to give me back to Danny.
Okay. What do you think happened to him?
I don't have a clue. I honestly will take any test that is pertaining to Danny's death. And that I even knew anything about it, I'll gladly take any test.
He goes on to say that even though it may not sound like a favor to detectives, that's all he was trying to do for Danny. A favor. He stressed how the kids at school were spreading rumors about him and looking at him differently ever since Danny was found, and told detectives he'd do anything to prove his innocence. Eventually, he'd take that lie detector test he asked for, and he'd pass it. No deception detected. And while this wouldn't totally clear him as a person of interest, I have to think it took a lot of heat off him. But at the beginning of this episode, I mentioned there were two things about this so-called acid night that need to be explored. We've covered the first, the story of how they picked up the acid. Now, I want to turn the attention back to that health scare Danny suffered after returning to Willard, because whatever that was, it sounds worse than your typical bad trip, and I'd like to get a better understanding of why it happened in the first place.
Not only did he have a seizure, but it sounds like he had a bad trip. Unfortunately, this data was not available back in the 90s, but we know now that combining lithium with a psychedelic medication actually significantly increases your risk of seizures.
Sure, we know that whatever happened that night didn't kill Danny, but it's only fair to question whether or not the same thing could have happened again the next night. After word spread about the events of Friday night, a popular theory arose amongst the locals. Many believed that Danny's death was just a freak accident, with drugs being the likely catalyst. And while the theory doesn't immediately jump out at me, I can see the logic. You hear about the supposed acid night and a near-death experience Danny had at his friend's house. It makes you wonder, could the same thing have happened again at a later time? On our drive through Willard, with Danielle and Eric, we actually talked about this as we drove through the east side of town, past Matt and Judd's houses, where all of this took place.
This is the east side. This is what they call it. Even though now it's the northern part of town, everybody still knows it as the east side.
Why don't you direct them to Matt's house first?
Yep.
So once they got back from Galleon from getting the acid, they went to Matt's. So they do the acid. They're up in Matt's room and they are like all kind of laughing, like they're starting to trip, and they had a strobe light going off and Danny started to seize. And if I remember correctly, they said he kind of like almost rolled off the bed or like wedged himself in between the bed and the wall, and they took him to Judd's, which is where we can go next.
And the narrative for a long time locally was that it was drug related and he potentially just overdosed, right?
Yeah. You know, it's just so hard to imagine somebody that would have wanted to hurt Danny. So because there is like this apparent lack of motive, I think people rationalized it for themselves, like, oh, some sort of accident, you know, occurred, or well, what do you mean he had a sheet of acid? You know, like it's that explains everything then.
Yeah.
So
let's take a moment to talk about Danny's toxicology and autopsy reports. We'll start with the toxicology. First, I want to note that there was no alcohol found in Danny's system. There was also no lithium or other prescribed drugs, which is alarming at first glance. The only two drugs listed in the report were trace amounts of LSD and an anti-seizure medication, Zorontin, which he was not prescribed. As for the autopsy report, the manner of death was ruled undetermined. The cause of death was asphyxia. And this is where some questions come into play, because there are a few different types, one being strangulation, or the compression of one's neck. According to the CDC, in 2021, strangulation accounted for roughly 26% of suicides in America, whereas for homicides, strangulation accounted for less than 2%. But another type is suffocation, or a blockage of the airways, which is how seizures, or more specifically convulsions, can kill someone. These deaths would be classified as either natural or accidental, depending on the circumstances. Now, this is just some basic research I pulled. I'm far from an expert on any of the above, but I was fortunate enough to interview someone who is qualified to speak on these matters.
My name is Alyssa Peckham. I'm a pharmacist by training, and I really dedicated a lot of my postgraduate work and studying in the realm of CNS disorders, so the central nervous system. And one of the biggest pieces there is psychiatry and addiction. So I'm boarded in both psychiatry and addiction, and that's really where I've practiced a lot of my clinical work thus far. I was inspired to help those with substance use disorders is because there are a couple of members of my family that struggle in that capacity. So it's very near and dear to my heart, but it is something that I really hope the best for a lot of people out there. And I don't think the medical community has done right by them for a long time. So I wanted to be a part of that changing movement.
While Dr. Peckham is currently doing biomedical research for rare central nervous system diseases, she tells me she practiced most of her clinical work in psychiatry and addiction, which is a big passion of hers. When she read about Danny's medical history with bipolar disorder and the various drugs he was taking, the ones he was prescribed, and the illicit ones found in his toxicology report, it sounded all too familiar.
It piqued my interest because I've seen someone like Danny in the clinic time and time again. So, you know, diagnoses of bipolar disorder, really trying to stabilize medications, perhaps dabbling in what we would consider to be street substances or illegal substances, really just to feel better, not to be classified as a, you know, a bad person or a moral failing. We see all the time that people are just seeking wellness, and that's why they use those substances. And so he struck me as a patient that could have been sitting in front of me years later, who I would have jumped at to help in a heartbeat. And so I wanted to learn more.
Danny's case fed right into her passion of working with people who suffer from both addiction and CNS disorders. We know that Danny was prescribed lithium and Seroquel, both known to treat the effects of bipolar disorder, so I first asked her to educate me on these drugs he was taking.
Lithium is a very classic mood stabilizer, one of our oldest mood stabilizers, and it's a very appropriate medication for bipolar disorder. It is FDA approved to treat just that, and I would consider it to be one of the gold standards, actually, for bipolar disorder. So it's my understanding he was taking 900 milligrams at bedtime, which is a very standard dose for his age. The other medication, Seroquel, that he was prescribed, he was actually in the midst of a taper off of that. So he should have been taking, I think, 75 milligrams at bedtime. And again, FDA approval for bipolar disorder, although being classified as an antipsychotic, more in the realm of schizophrenia. But people get very scared of that term. But a lot of antipsychotics can do a lot of really wonderful things in terms of symptom resolution for patients that have either unipolar depression or bipolar depression.
While Danny had nearly tapered off from the Seroquel he was prescribed, he was still supposed to be taking a standard dose of lithium, which, based on his medical records, he appeared to be doing. For the most part, that is. She tells me that on October 22nd, roughly 48 hours before his disappearance, he had what she would consider a proper amount of lithium in his system. But where she struggled was comparing his medical records to the toxicology report.
I have a hard time believing that there was none detected in his system just 2 days later, or perhaps even 3 days later. You know, I try to put myself in his shoes and think about what was happening the days after 10:22 when he had that nice healthy level. And it seems like he was out with friends, perhaps that there was some partying that took place that evening. I've certainly forgotten to take medications the next day after a long night out. So it could just have been that he forgot. But I still think that there should have been some detection of it in the next 2 to 3 days based on what looks like how stable he was prior to that.
Though it's strange to her that no lithium was detected in the toxicology, she has no real concerns over any of the prescribed drugs that Danny was taking, even if he stopped taking his lithium for a day or two. But what about the other drugs found in his system, namely the acid, or LSD as she describes it?
So LSD, its name stands for lysergic acid diethylamide. It's a small molecule. Oftentimes they're in these little dots that you can kind of take off of a sheet of paper. And when someone takes it, there are enhanced sensations. There can sometimes be visual hallucinations, maybe increased spirituality, an increased feeling of unity or community, sometimes a warm feeling. And so a lot of the experiences that are described are pleasant, but there's certainly room for what I think is called bad trips. And so having that breakthrough, anxiety, paranoia, undesirable effects.
She says the average person starts to feel the varied effects of LSD roughly 30 minutes after taking it, and they can last for upwards of 12 hours. But I was curious about the half-life of LSD and whether she could determine the amount Danny consumed Friday night based on the level shown in the toxicology report. Or more importantly, could she determine if he had taken it again the next day?
The half-life of LSD is about 3.5 hours. So we really expect LSD to be undetectable and not really affecting someone by about 12 to 18 hours later. And so without knowing how much Danny took, I can only assume that he took what we would consider to be within the realm of a normal street dose of LSD. And so that can be anywhere between 20 to 200 micrograms. At the time, in the 90s, we didn't have a lot of research into how LSD affects the body and when it can be eliminated. But since then, there are publications as recent as 2020 that really looked at the time course of LSD through the body. And so for doses that ranged between 25 and 100 micrograms, the level in the body was at the level that we saw show up on Danny's tox report. So that says to me that perhaps the dose that he took that's reflected in his blood was taken at least 12 hours prior. Now, if he had taken the very highest dose, so let's say 200 micrograms, that level would come down to the one that we saw in his toxicology report about 24 hours later. So I think regardless, however much he took was at least 12 to 24 hours prior.
Based on that time frame, she feels fairly certain that Danny did not consume any more LSD the next day, though she admits it can't be ruled out entirely. But there was another drug found in the toxicology report that raised concerns, an anti-seizure medication, Zorontin. Where he got this from is a mystery in itself, but we can pretty safely assume why he took it. That said, I wanted to know whether or not we should have any concerns over him taking it.
It's interesting that he's not prescribed this medication, yet it's showing up not at therapeutic levels in his toxicology. It's actually on its way out in terms of metabolism. So it's present, but it's not to the effect that would indicate very recent exposure. So I have two theories here with the level that's in Danny's body. The first theory, which I think is far less plausible, but we'll talk about it for the purposes of being complete. There's potential that for whatever reason, he was seeking therapy with Zorontin. I don't know why. It doesn't have good effects. It's not treating any condition that Danny has. What is more likely the case is that he took a one-time dose to treat something very specific. And so in this case, if he did have LSD and lithium, a strobe light combination that induced a seizure, it's possible that someone had given him that medication knowing that it's an anti-epileptic, which is not going to give us the same blood concentrations that we would expect in someone that takes it regularly. And so that could explain the very low levels in his toxicology as well.
I then asked Dr. Peckham whether or not she could pinpoint what exactly caused the seizure Danny had that night, as it seems that several factors might have played into it.
So we're doing a Seroquel taper. We have perhaps a missed dose of lithium in there. And then on top of that, we have acute exposure to LSD the night before. Not only did he have a seizure, but it sounds like he had a bad trip. Unfortunately, this data was not available back in the 90s, but we know now that combining lithium with a psychedelic medication actually significantly increases your risk of seizures. And then you add a strobe light. We know that strobe lights can induce or elicit seizures, primarily in people that already have a seizure disorder, but his threshold was lessened with the combination of lithium and a psychedelic agent. And so that would be my theory as to why a seizure or seizures had occurred that evening.
She tells me that while it can't be ruled out entirely, based on the evidence, there's no solid reason to believe that this same incident occurred again the next day, ultimately leading to Danny's death. For good measure, she also spoke on the possibility of an overdose, which she has no real concern over.
Unfortunately, it's not that well documented in the literature if LSD as a sole agent is causing overdoses, but I think we can at least take confidence in the fact that if it's not well documented and not reported, then perhaps it's not happening all that much. That is not to say that it comes without risk, certainly, because as we know, it changes the way that we perceive things, it changes our thoughts, and it changes our behaviors. So it can certainly put us in risky situations, but in terms of being the causative agent for death, we don't see that often. And then certainly in Danny's case, I don't think that was the cause here. You don't take LSD, have a bad trip, go to sleep, wake up the next day, feel a little groggy, have everyone later on in the day report that you were fine and engaging in conversations, and then you end up dead in a cornfield. I have a hard time linking that back to LSD.
The way she sees it, we have to take away the stigma surrounding LSD, primarily its presence in toxicology reports. Could using it or even buying it expose someone like Danny to a potentially risky situation? Absolutely. But there's no definitive proof that it played a role in his death. While Dr. Peckham admits that she's no expert in the world of forensic pathology, for her, the most telling clues as to what might have happened to Danny stem from his autopsy.
Reviewing autopsy reports and making a medical judgment on that is certainly not within my realm, but I will say the one thing that stuck out to me is the postmortem abrasions that were found. How do you explain that? I think it would benefit from having someone else comment on that, because to me, that sounds like there was another person involved in perhaps moving or manipulating the body in some capacity after they were deceased, and that's suspicious, to say the least.
I can tell you, looking over the details of Danny's autopsy would raise anyone's suspicions. The postmortem abrasions she mentioned are only a glimpse into the troubling discoveries found in that report.
It's a young kid, 17 years old, in the middle of a cornfield, and he's got very definite pathologic findings. I mean, there's all different kinds of scenarios you can think of, but no one ever had a plausible explanation. Did they get scared and have to dump the body? Was this just all good fun that went bad? I don't know. But I think you have to keep an open mind for that, because if you are doing acid, God knows the different possibilities.
That's next time.
Culpable is a production of Tenderfoot TV in partnership with Odyssey, written and hosted by Dennis Cooper. Our senior producer is John Street. Our producer is Jamie Albright. Edit, mix, and sound design by Dayton Cole. Voice acting by Amanda Sanders. You can follow us on social media at Culpable Podcast. And lastly, if you have any information about the death of Danny Violet, please fill out the form on our website, culpablepodcast.com, or contact the Huron County Sheriff's Office at 419-668-6912. A new episode of Culpable will release next Monday, but you can binge additional episodes right now, ad-free, by subscribing to Tenderfoot Plus on Apple Podcasts or at tenderfootplus.com.
Do you know that feeling when you're at happy hour with your friends and you listen to them monologue about their current fixation or their work drama, and you just think to yourself, God, I love my friends. I could listen to this forever. Well, I do. And that is why 10 years ago, I started a podcast with my best friend, Julia Schifini, who loves to yap about Greek myths, creepypasta, and death. That is, in fact, what you can find every week on our podcast, Spirits, where we pour a drink every single week and learn about a new story from around the world. That includes urban legends, ancient myths, modern folklore, all through a queer feminist lens of two people who are figuring out life and love each other along the way. So if you want spooky stories from our listeners' hometowns, haunted old spaghetti factory, anyone, or deep dives with brilliant scholars about everything from disability and folklore to ancient Sumerian religion to the myths of AI supremacy, you will get it on Spirits. Subscribe now or go to spiritspodcast.com for more.